founding fathers did not live in a world with domestic restraining orders. So how should we interpret the Second Amendment today? From SDPB, today is Tuesday, June 27th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a 2020 U.S. Supreme Court decision opened the door for what promises to be a series of cases about how we regulate guns in America. Mike Thompson joins us to talk about the recent United States v. Rahimi decision and why the court said it's okay to disarm domestic violence suspects. Then we explore the impact of the arts and arts education in the state. Actor Deborah Christofferson is with us from Spearfish to talk about her career in Hollywood. Plus, our friend Hank Harris has a new CD. He joins us later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court says it is constitutional to restrict an American's gun rights in certain cases of domestic violence. It's a significant clarification for the court. The majority opinion, written by Chief Justice John Roberts, declares that the law is not, quote, trapped in amber. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He stopped by the SDPB studios for clarity on United States v. Rahimi.
So this fellow Rahimi, he was adjudged a person who was a credible threat to another. The judge said, you are likely to commit violence against your intimate partner, therefore I'm going to subject you to this order that keeps you away from her. And he violated the order. He shot at her. The shooting at her is what culminated in the protection order in the first place, keeping him away from her. And then he violated the order and finally was convicted of that. And he started early on contesting the fact that he would not be able to own a firearm, own or possess a firearm, because he would be subject to a domestic protection order. And that was his claim, that it violates my Second Amendment protection to be disarmed because of that order.
And a few years ago, this might not have even made it to the Supreme Court, but we need some clarification from a previous ruling.
Oh, yes, we do.
So there's a reason that this case about a pretty much universally deemed, dangerous man,
yes,
would claim Second Amendment protection under... What? What were his lawyers thinking that maybe the window had opened for this kind of case?
The Bruin case, New York versus Bruin, is the window opener. The law on the Second Amendment was pretty set from the late 30s until Heller, D.C. versus Heller in 2008. That's the big opinion that Scalia wrote that really explored the origins of the Second and how it was written. That was the case about the prefatory clause and how do we interpret it. Does it just apply to a militia? So that happened in Heller. And then in 2010, McDonald versus Chicago was the case that said the Second Amendment also applies to state regulation through the due process clause of the 14th. Mm-hmm. So the Second was the last fundamental right to be applied to the states, which is somewhat important to when we look at Justice Roberts's opinion in Rahimi. So then we have McDonald, and then we get to Bruin, and that's Clarence Thomas's opinion of a majority of the court that said that we have to look at the regulations in place at the founding to determine if the present day regulation is like that regulation. Mm-hmm. If the present-day regulation is, then the regulation is constitutional. If it isn't, then the regulation is unconstitutional.
Right. So now we have this case about whether or not you can restrict somebody who's under a domestic violence, restraining order or protection order. And the justices say, yes, you still can.
Right.
And Roberts writes the opinion, and what are some of the things that he says in the opinion that address not only Rahimi in this case, but this broader idea of how we think about the Second Amendment?
So he talks first about, and we talked about this back in December when the case was argued, he talks first about this as a facial challenge. Rahimi's making a facial challenge, which means that he has the burden of showing that this regulation, which is in the federal code, it's 922G8, that this regulation violates his Second Amendment protection, and there's no set of circumstances under which it could be constitutional, which is an extremely difficult burden for him to have. And interestingly, the Fifth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, when they first heard his case before Bruin, they decided against him. Bruin comes out and says, hey, we have to look at regulations that are historically rooted in the American tradition. And then the Fifth Circuit says, well, wait a minute. We're going to find that the regulation is unconstitutional because there's nothing about a domestic violence restraining order back in the founding era. So therefore, it's unconstitutional. So you get, which sets up this, do we have to find an historical twin in the founding era, or can it be a historical analog? Something comparable.
Something comparable. Yeah. Is this a dialogue? I mean, for us to zoom out for a minute, are we watching a conversation between the courts where the Supreme Court says something and then a lower court says, well, what about this? You haven't clarified this. And the Supreme Court says, okay, hold my beer. I'm going to explain what we're thinking. And then the lower court goes, okay, but still not. I mean, it kind of feels like there's a conversation that is about more than the lives of one man who's been incarcerated.
Right. I think Justice Roberts, in his opinion, is telling the Fifth Circuit and other lower courts, hey, just wait a minute. He doesn't say it's stupid, but he says that's an asinine way to read what we said in Bruin, that you have to have a historical twin. It's a historical analog. In defense of some of those lower court judges, that wasn't altogether clear from Bruin, that I'm looking for a historical analog and not a twin.
And this gets to this idea of originalism, which lots of people have opinions about.
Yes.
When we look at the human beings that are currently U.S. Supreme Court justices and what they have said about originalism. And so you have in the opinion all these other, what are they called, concurrent opinions?
Concurrent opinions.
Thank you. I'm learning. Who else has something to say about this? Why do so many of them have something to say about it?
Everybody had something to say.
Okay.
So it's an 8-1 decision, which means that 8 of them agreed in the result, which is that the regulation is constitutional. Justice Thomas, of course, who was the author of Bruin, he disagrees. He dissents. So it's 8-1. You have Kavanaugh, who gives a great exposition on how the Constitution is or should be interpreted. Talks about originalism, talks about all the approaches to historical analysis, things like that. It's something a history student should read. And then Coney Barrett, she talks about, okay, here's what originalism is, and takes us through her rendition of what originalism means. And she, of course, learned that from Scalia when she was his clerk, and he a big originalist. Also, so we hear that. Gorsuch writes just a short thing about the facial challenge. When at oral argument, he was just on that, that there's no way Rahimi can meet this burden. And that's what his opinion is about. And Thomas's, of course, is about the historical twin versus the historical analog.
Thomas is the dissent.
Thomas is the dissent.
Okay. How about and Kagan and Sotomayor?
Kagan and Sotomayor agree in the result. And Jackson, too, they agree in the result that, yes, the regulation is constitutional, but they all three say that Bruin is wrongly decided, that it's bad precedent.
Okay. So what is this telling us, that the architect of Bruin, Justice Thomas, is alone in his dissent? What can we read about that?
That the area of regulation of the Second Amendment is broader than Justice Thomas believes it to be, and it's broader than the majority in Bruin believes it to be. Mm-hmm. It's like Justice Roberts is saying, just wait a minute, it's not going to be that narrow. There are going to be regulations on gun rights that are going to be constitutional, even if we can't find something exactly in the founding era that supports it today.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about Justice Roberts is he talks about the 14th Amendment and how at the time of the ratification of the 14th, former slaves were arming themselves to protect themselves against former Confederates. And he talks about that as being a justification for regulation. So the question is, the court's been looking at gun rights from the founding era up through the Civil War. Does this mean that we're going to look at regulations, other historical regulations that have been in existence since the Civil War, since he mentioned the 14th? So it's a pretty young area of the law in constitutional terms. So it's going to be, it's going to be fun to see, but it might be painful depending on your vision.
Right. Okay. So that brings us to what happens next. What other windows have been opened? I think the thing that will stick out to me, and I think will stick out to a lot of people, is this this idea that this was not cast in amber.
Right. And I had to look that up.
Yeah.
I didn't know what, I mean, I knew what amber is.
Yeah.
A color. But I would cast in amber. I had to look that up. I hope that's no...
You've not seen Jurassic Park?
No, I have not. I probably just disparaged the University of Sioux Falls.
So it's just not frozen in time.
Right,
and
right.
That we need... So that it's not a purist originalism. And a lot of people are going to be excited about that. And other people are going to be really frustrated. At like, what have you just opened the door to say that you can just willy-nilly decide what the founders wanted? Stir the pot.
Right. Yeah. So the casting in amber looks more like an originalist, and the originalists always say, well, the court can't sit as a policymaker.
Right.
But if it's not cast in amber and it's got some boundaries that are hazy at the present time, that might involve some balancing.
Yeah. All right. So what happens next? What kinds of cases do you think we might see in gun rights and gun regulation going forward?
The federal government says that a felon cannot own a firearm. I think that's there are cases weaving their way up that contest that regulation. So I think that's going to be the next big place. That okay, I've got a felony for failure to pay child support. That means I can't own a gun. I think we're going to see more on that. I can see the court saying that some of these felonies don't relate to dangerousness. So you can't take a gun away for that felony. But it's hard to say.
One at a time.
One at a time.
That's Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Actor Deborah Christofferson returns to South Dakota to talk about her film and television career. She is known for roles on NYPD Blue and 911. Her film credits include 1997's dark comedy slapstick Mousetrap with Nathan Lane. She's appeared on The X-Files, Grey's Anatomy, NCIS, American Horror Story. The High Plains Western Heritage Center is going to host a movie career presentation and reception for Deborah on June 30th. That's happening at 1:30 p.m. local time. And Deborah Christofferson is seated at the SDPB's Sue W. White Studio on the campus of Black Hill State University in Spearfish. Deborah, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
What is it like to come home to the state after, how often do you get back?
Usually a couple times a year.
Yeah.
I don't often come in the summertime, so it's really nice to see how green it is.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, I want to talk about your acting career and things like auditioning and some of your big breaks, but at this point in your career, what do you look back on from your time at the University of South Dakota or your time on stage in South Dakota in the Black Hills that you really carried with you to Minneapolis, to New York, to Hollywood?
Our theater department was quite small, and so there was a lot of camaraderie and support out in the real world. There's a lot of competition, and you found that it was way more supportive. Mm-hmm. And so I learned the gentle art of compromise and cooperation, and learn to take that with me in things that I do, so that it's never about competing with other people. It's only about competing with yourself, because that's really the only competition you'll ever have.
Were you able to turn that into a strength, being from the Midwest, or was it something that just made you feel lonely? Like, what was that like at first when you realized what a different environment you were in?
I think it's a strength. We joke about, you can always tell when you meet someone from the Midwest because they're always so open and friendly.
Yeah.
And just willing to, again, I'll go back to the word cooperation. There's just an openness and a friendliness, and it's like we all work together. And, you know, maybe part of that is being from small towns where there's a real community, mm-hmm. and you need to support each other in order to succeed, as opposed to dog-eat-dog world, you know, which sometimes Hollywood can be.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about some of that auditioning and networking and breaking in as you navigated that as a young actor and as you grew into, like, how am I going to do this in a way that has integrity for me? Tell us a story about some of those early experiences.
Well, it's interesting. Scott, your liaison here in Spearfish, and I were speaking earlier before the show started about how I wish there were certain classes that I had at USD to prepare me for acting out in, you know, the real world, such as how to write a resume. Never learned that. And certain auditioning techniques and how stage is just so much different than television or film or commercials. And we developed a class while we were sitting here talking for 10 minutes of, career development, you know, and certain things that would be really helpful and beneficial for especially actors, but, you know, also other for radio DJs and, you know, different people in the industry, what could be really helpful before after you graduate and when you actually go out and try and find jobs. So I went to Minneapolis for a couple of years after I graduated just to get theater under my belt, to get some credits on that elusive resume. And Star Wars came out, and I saw it, and it literally changed my life. It was so magical, and it was so fun, and it sort of codified my idea of what God is, not some man with a long beard up on a throne somewhere in an elusive heaven, but rather it's everywhere and everything, and it goes through you, and it goes through me, and, you know, it's like space. It goes through everything that binds us all together. And that really appealed to me as what the universe is. And so that was important. And then it just was so much fun and magical. And I thought, no, I want to do that. So instead of going to New York, which had been my original plan, I moved to Los Angeles, which also was warmer than living two years in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
So I ended up there and started working as a legal secretary. That was some of the training I had in Minneapolis for a day job, and was fortunate enough to be good enough at that they would allow me to go and audition when I needed to. I'd take all my vacation time and in 2 and 3 hour increments and go and audition. First of all, there was a paper called the Drama Log, and they would have audition notices in the Drama Log for actors who didn't have agents and for people who were looking for representation. And so that's how I would first get audition notices. And the very first thing that I did was a student film at UCLA.
Okay.
And it was a musical. And I learned the hard way a lesson that I wish I'd learned in college, which was I was doing this film and I was supposed to run up to the camera and sing into the camera. And we were in a gym, so I ran up to the camera, I started singing into the camera, and then I started playing the audience and singing into the mirror. Just like, no, Deborah, sing into the camera. And I went back up a second time, and I did it again. It was just a natural thing to, like, sing, you know, play to the audience.
Yeah.
And so it took me 3 tries, and then I finally was like, okay, we'll focus on the camera. Now, if that would have been on a professional level, it would have cost tens of thousands of dollars. Making a mistake like that's such a rookie mistake, because I didn't have that kind of training in front of a camera. I had never worked in front of a camera in my college years. It was strictly stage.
Yeah.
So that was a really good lesson to learn right off the bat.
And I wonder if, like, sometimes in South Dakota schools, when we talk on this show about the arts, we often go into well, this is really going to help you be a good teacher or a good doctor. Like, we think of all those really legitimate ways that arts education helps us be good human beings. But yes. I think this is a really good moment to remind teachers and professors that there are students who want to do this for a job, and they need to understand in their classes the tools and the skills and the techniques that will help them do this professionally.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Like at USD, we didn't have, not that I was aware of, we didn't have a relationship with the media department, with the broadcasting department, sure. and communications. And there should have been, so that we could be on radio, so that we could be in front of the camera, so that we learned how to run a camera, which I have to do now for my auditions because auditioning has changed over the years.
Right.
And it would have been very helpful to have that experience before I went out and tried to get a job and truly didn't know exactly what I was doing.
Yeah.
So working on that student film was a wonderful way to get a few lessons in what it's like to be on a film set, which is completely different than being on a soundstage for TV or in front of an audience doing stage work or in front of a camera doing a commercial. They're all very different styles and techniques. For example, you're large on stage because if you don't have a mic on, you have to project and reach the back row. Mm-hmm. If you're in a commercial, it's more chipper and, you know, usually there's more energy and more uplifting. On TV, you have to tone it down from stage, but if you're in a comedy, you're on a live sound stage and you have an audience, and so you're still playing to an audience. But in film, you have to really bring that down and tone it down and change your acting technique because you're going to be on a 18-foot or bigger film screen. In a movie theater.
Okay, in that
sense.
So they're
all very different techniques that would be very helpful to learn.
And just tell us now, what is it like to make a scene in a film that is an iconic 1997 slapstick auction scene where Nathan Lane puts his hand down your shirt looking for... Well, he's not looking for the mouse, but this sort of famous Buster Keaton, Three Stooges, Peter Sellers, Pink Panther. Like it's comedy, it's choreographed, it's over the top. Take us to the anatomy of that scene and tell me a little bit about what was happening to make all that happen. What can you tell us that we would find interesting? Yes.
Well. Obviously, in the scene in the movie Mouse Hunt,
Mouse Trap? I meant Mouse.
Yeah,
Hunt.
But that's a lot of people
Thanks.
Do. No,
all right.
It starts with a mouse. It's easy.
Yeah.
the mouse jumps down. The woman who's playing my sister jumps down her dress.
Yeah.
And so Lee Evans, who plays Nathan Lane's brother, jams his hand down her dress,
For the mouse.
Yeah. Looking for the mouse. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember if it was the director. Or Nathan that said, well, then I should, Roy said I should have his hand down my blouse,
right.
down my dress. And so I just, as an actor, I just grabbed his hand and stuck it down my blouse.
Yeah.
And it just came out of the moment, one of those magical moments on camera.
Yeah.
And so that's where that came from. It wasn't scripted. It's just like, okay, if he's going to do that, then maybe I should do that. So we did.
Yeah. was that really fun, or was it just a whole lot of work to film that scene?
It was fun.
It was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's like if you can't have fun, you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
You know? Even in dramatic stuff, it can be fun.
Yeah.
And it was. I'm trying to think. The whole setup was the auction. So this was the first time that we had a lot of people in the scene. So there was a lot of moving parts and stuff. And we just were sitting there and just doing it over and over again. And the more we did it, the sillier it got. And, and that makes it fun and funny if you can have a good time with it.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the other roles that you might attach to or that fans have really attached to with you that you look at your career and you say, I want to be remembered for that one.
Well, in an odd way to be remembered for playing Jerry Turner on NYPD Blue.
Yeah.
It's an odd thing to be remembered because you're wearing a rubber bustier. But that one was, I literally was walking down the street in Beverly Hills and somebody drove past and said, "Show us your rubber." I'm like, "What?" And then they recognized me just walking down the street and I was like, "Okay." And I went to I can remember going to an audition shortly after the episode aired where, in case people haven't seen it, let me backtrack a little bit. Mm-hmm. My character had a boyfriend who was into auto asphyxiation. Mm-hmm. And so she was wearing rubber, which is part of that whole scenario. Mm-hmm. And she thought it would be attractive to Andy Sipowicz if she came on to him with the whole rubber fetish.
If you haven't seen it.
Played by Dennis Franz. Mm-hmm. And so there's a scene in the squad room where she turns to him and she opens up her blouse and she's wearing a rubber bustier.
Yeah.
And he's very flustered and doesn't know what to do. And just a quick sidebar here. We were shooting the scene and Jimmy Smits and Nick Turturro were standing off to the side within the scene, but we were shooting our coverage. And they were standing off to the side and could barely keep from laughing every time I opened my shirt. And it was so hard for us to not laugh, speaking of having fun, because they just could not keep it together. And it was humorous in the moment. It's not in the show itself.
Right, yeah.
It was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience working on that show. And it was a very striking character because you ultimately find out that she's very... she has a worth problem. She has a worth issue. She doesn't feel worthy, and she has, you know, issues and stuff. And so ultimately, you end up feeling sorry for her. With her behavior was off-putting initially, and then you realize it's like it came from a deeper, a very sad part of her soul. And so it was a really wonderful challenge as an actor to play that part. And I had people reaching out to me saying that it meant a lot to them because they'd been in, you know, similar issues emotionally. And so I love that. And then I played a part on a show called Carnival, mm-hmm. which was a wonderful show set in the 1930s. It was a metaphysical tale of good versus evil. And I played the bearded lady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people were real big fans of that show. And it was totally before its time. Mm-hmm. And now it would be a gigantic hit. But it cost a lot of money, and it didn't have as big a viewership as HBO was hoping. So we only lasted 2 seasons. But that is also a character that, because it was so different, that I would like people to remember me for.
You're drawn to those, those roles.
It seems to me from the outside.
Yeah, you're drawn to, you know, something that's different they haven't done before. Okay, so the presentation and reception is for Deborah is at the High Plains Western Heritage Center in Spearfish. That's June 30th at 1:30 Mountain Time. It's free. It's open to the public. There's going to be some clips and some discussion. And Deborah, anything you have coming up that you want to plug away for the South Dakota listeners? Yeah.
Yes, thank you. We're starting season 8 of 911, which I have been very blessed to be a part of. We'll be starting shooting that at the end of July. I just finished a movie with Jennifer Love Hewitt called The Holiday Junkie. It's a Christmas movie that will be airing on Lifetime on December 14th.
Nice.
And I also just finished a movie called Redux. Mm-hmm. And it's a science fiction film about a woman traveling through multiverses, seeking revenge for a terrible tragedy.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Well, thank you for spending time with us and for all the actors and young kids who want to be on the stage and on the screen. I'm sure they're going to love hearing you as well. So we appreciate your spending time doing that.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
We will take a break. When we come back, musician Hank Harris has new music. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB.
Another failed New Year's resolution. Another stupid mood. Another phone. The word is out, we're not gonna make it. Too late to turn around. Another flim flam, another con man.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. You're listening there to a little bit of the song Beautiful Planet. It's the latest release from Black Hills musician Hank Harris. Hank is a longtime South Dakota artist and legend on our music scene. He's played with many bands, including the Red Willow Band and Dee Dee and the Pharaohs. He also makes stunning photographs, which are featured in the latest album's packaging. He's with us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Hank, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Hi, Lori. I wish I could see you.
I say,
it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to hear you. Nice to hear you in my ears. I'm holding your album, and so when I look at your pictures, I feel like I'm seeing you.
There you go.
Let's start with the photos, shall we?
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of pictures you're trying to make. Are you thinking about them for album art? Are you thinking about them as fine art pieces? What's your relationship with photography?
I really take pictures because I like to take pictures.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for beauty. But, you know, now that I'm making some videos with these two, I'm thinking in terms of that to make, you know, a product for whatever I'm trying to talk about. So it's branching out a little, but the beautiful planet theme and the pictures that I love to take of nature seem to go together, so I included some of them in this particular package.
And when we listen to the song Beautiful Planet and we look at the pictures, I'm wondering if it's bearing witness to things that we won't have anymore, if it's a call to action. What are your thoughts on that?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I did have some pictures that I didn't have access to when I put this together of being at the beach in Florida and taking countless pictures of the garbage that's washed up on beaches. And I kind of wished I'd included a little bit of that, too. But I just tried to put the beautiful things in there and let people put two and two together and go, oh, we need to take care of this.
Yeah. This is not something that you have come to recently. This has been a long life of paying attention to, how do I want to say this, of like rejecting consumerism and, you know, living with less than you probably maybe would have been comfortable with and traveling about as a musician, as an artist, and as a human being. Tell me a little bit about how your view of ecology has changed with your life.
Well, when I was young, I just liked the beauty of it, and I liked being out in it. And as the years have gone by, and we've seen the obvious repercussions of greed and neglect and politics, it's just become more apparent that we need to wake up pretty quick here, or we won't be waking up at all at some point.
What makes an idea turn into a song for you? As I listen to the full album, Beautiful Planet, there are, you know, melancholy meditations, lyrical ballads, you know, kind of poppier, groovy, coming alongside with cancer. I mean, there's all kinds of things that spark your interest. When you have an idea, what makes you want to turn it into a song?
It just depends. I was noticing on this today that two of the songs came from actual pieces I heard on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Really?
Modern Medicine, and what's the other one? 11 Time Zones East. 11 Time Zones East, I heard years ago, I think it was a Terry Gross piece on the drone jockeys, the guy who were flying drones from Langley Air Force Base or Arizona or wherever they were, dropping bombs on people in the Middle East, and then going home and dealing with the PTSD from that.
Yeah.
And I just kind of tucked that away and said, that's an interesting topic. So that one finally came to fruition. Another one of these songs, Beauty Make Promises, Makes Promises, came from a book I read by Cormac McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he used that line, and I went back to the old adage, I steal from the best.
I'm so still mad at him.
I just thought, I didn't know what that song would be about, but I just said, that's a great line, and I'm going to try to find a place to use it.
I'm still mad at Cormac
McCarthy. The full line being, beauty makes promises that beauty can't keep.
Oh, such a writer. Yeah. How do you not do something with that line,
I
right?
mean, I was yeah. like, I was like, I was writing, listening to that on audiobook out in the Badlands that day, and I pulled over just to write that down so I would remember it.
Yeah. When you hear the music reaching audiences, what is that? Do you have hopes for that? Do you have feedback from that? Do people call you and say, hey, that song got me through this time? How is it reflected back to you?
Sometimes it doesn't get reflected back. The last, and we talked about it, we did a show on it, Together CD, but
mm-hmm. yeah,
COVID pretty much just washed that out. It just didn't mm-hmm. get any attention. I wasn't able to present it anywhere. This one, I'm hoping we get a little more chance to put it out, and my management and friend Jimmy Goins out in California, who's really the head of all this in a lot of ways. He's the one who pushes me to do things. We're trying harder to actually go a little more of a traditional route of trying to market it, because I do want to get this out. I do want people to hear it.
Yeah. Because we want people to hear it, too, also because it's South Dakota music. So part of when we look at your song catalog and the bands that you've played with, one of the things about that is that people will say, I saw them live, or mm-hmm. he is from here, or he is, you know, he's one of us. What does it mean to people of South Dakota to know that their artists are creating work that reaches the world?
Well, I hope it gives them a sense of inclusion and pride, and hopefully, though I don't always write about South Dakota topics, I hope these are topics that everybody can relate to.
Yeah. When is the full album available?
Full album will be available on the 9th of July. Okay. You can get the single on various platforms. Those various platforms will carry it digitally. And if you want to get in touch with me, go to my website, Hank Harris Music, and you can get in touch with me and get a hard copy of an actual CD if you'd like it. Because that has the pictures in it, and I want the whole package to go out if it can.
It's well worth it. Hank Harris, thank you so much. We're going to hear a little bit more of the song now, but thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Lori. I hope to get to talk to you more sometime.
Yeah, see you next time.
Such a beautiful planet. Another gridlock, another dead talk, another rock star, another jock star. Another gun rack, another six pack. One step up, two steps back. Who are these carols? The rubber barrels. Poison in the atmosphere. Same old day holes. Same old, same old. Just won't cut.